6. After allowing himself a few seconds to recover, Court removed his pack from his back and pushed it into the nearby eucalyptus, the IMSI catcher inside and forgotten. He pulled his Glock 19 pistol from the holster on his belt again and held it with one hand between his knees. After taking just a moment to decide on his course of action, he tapped his transmitter. Forcing calm into his voice, he said, "Copper, you reading me still?" The young woman sounded like she was on the verge of panic.
"What the hell are you doing? Why were you running? There are lights on in the middle of the bungalow, men looking over the rear courtyard with flashlights. Sir, there are 10 men outside the embassy now, and they are all searching for someone."
Court did not respond to any of this. His heart was racing as he tapped the transmit key again. "Copper, listen carefully. Spin the ball." There was a short delay.
Spin the what?
"I need you to spin the ball."
I don't know what that means, sir. That is code? Sir, I don't understand anything about what is happening right now."
Court sighed. He forgave her. He was using American military slang, but even though her English was flawless, she was obviously from India. Of course she'd have no clue what he was asking of her. His mind was racing right now. He wasn't thinking straight, and he needed to get his shit under control. He explained himself, speaking softly and quickly. "When a military unit wants the UAV overhead to stop monitoring their actions, they tell them to spin the ball. On the American Predator and Reaper drones, there is a ball in the nose cone that houses all the cameras. Spin the ball means turn the cameras away." He clarified for simplicity. "It means stop watching what I'm doing."
"Why would a military unit not want what they are doing recorded or watched?"
This, in Court's estimation, was a dumb question, but he didn't say this. Instead, he cut to the chase. "There's a man here on the embassy grounds, a man I recognize. I had no idea I was going to see him tonight, but I did, and there is only one thing I can do about it."
"What?"
Court did not hesitate. "I have to kill him. Trust me, this dude has it coming." The pause on the other side came just as he expected it to. When she spoke, her voice was weak, hoarse.
"No. No, sir. No, sir, you can't."
"Spin the ball, Copper. Now. In fact, break off all surveillance of this location. Recall the drone to your position. Pack up and get out of the country as soon as you can. Ending transmission. Good luck." He reached for the radio on his belt to turn it off, but the woman said,
"Wait, wait. I have to report this to Arjun."
Arjun was Court's broker, the man who hired him for the mission. "Of course you do. You're fine. You had nothing to do with this. This is me." Court looked around in the dark a moment, his pistol at the low ready. Softly, almost to himself, but still transmitting, he said, "It's always me."
"But..."
Court turned off his radio, stood, turned, and began moving back towards the rear of Bungalow 2. The guards patrolling the embassy grounds found the breach in the fence on the southern side of the property, and they radioed this news back to Nasir Rasool in the security office. The Pakistani had been speaking softly over the net about the drone and his additional search of the property, but now that he knew without a doubt that some sort of intrusion had taken place, he turned his head and shouted to the bored Turkish security men sitting at the monitors of the fixed cameras here at the embassy. In English, he said,
"You have an incursion! South side fence has been cut! Get all the lights on and everyone searching!"
The Pakistani had no authority to give orders here, but his news was more than adequate to get the men on their radios, barking instructions to the Turkish security staff all over the property. While they did this, the Pakistani at the table reached to his own radio.
"Roof! Release the counter-drone!"
It took just seconds for the response.
"This is the roof. Counter-drone is in the air."
Rasool opened a control panel on one of his screens and reached for his joystick. After a moment to make certain everything was working nominally, he said,
"Observation 1 confirms good control of the vehicle."
He manipulated his mouse and tapped a few keys.
"Vehicle lock on enemy aircraft initiated."
And then,
"Lock on acquired."
Almost instantly, the speed and trajectory of the tiny UAV he was tracking changed. Into the radio, he said,
"I think it's leaving the scene. They must have detected the security sweep. Enemy aircraft is heading east-southeast, speed increasing. We are going after that drone. Its range isn't far, and that means whoever has been watching us is nearby. Roll a car of men, and I'll vector them as able."
The man at the desk knew UAVs. He had personally acquired this state-of-the-art counter-surveillance equipment from China, technology that could protect any location from the spying eyes of a drone. And he knew that a UAV the size of the one he was tracking could probably last about 75 minutes tops before it needed to have its battery changed or recharged. A small battery meant a limited range, and whoever was operating this device would probably be somewhere within 5 or 10 minutes flying time of the Turkish embassy.
"I'll send the Indian along with 4 men, the Pakistani security director said through the radio. "We'll stay to help the Turks find out whoever is on the grounds."
A minute later, the black Mercedes screeched out of the underground garage and began racing towards the front gate and the street. Copper initiated the recall of her UAV, then began pacing around in circles in her suite with a phone to her ear. Her call was answered on the third ring by Arjun, and both the man on the other line and the woman in the hotel suite spoke Hindi to one another.
"Is it done?" the man asked.
"It's not done. It is shit. Absolute shit. What have you got me involved with?"
"Calm down. What are you talking about?"
"The asset just informed me he is going to kill a man on the premises."
Arjun was clearly gobsmacked.
"Kill a man? Why?"
"I don't know."
"I did not hire him to kill anybody. He was only supposed to plant the equipment."
"I told him this. Then he told me to bring the UAV back to my location and to leave the country. I am doing that now. I don't want to be a part of an assassination."
There was a slight pause. And then the man said,
"I want you out of there."
"Believe me, I am leaving."
"Get to the airport. I'll put you on the first flight to anywhere."
"Okay."
After a pause, she said,
"What is happening?"
I don't know. It's the fucking American. He is ruining everything."
She ended the call, then ran into her bedroom to begin packing. Court couldn't believe his luck. He found an unlocked ground floor window on the north side of Bungalow 2. There were blinds on the window, so he couldn't see into the room, but he was at least able to tell that the lights were off in this part of the building. A search of the inside of the window satisfied him that it was not wired with a security alarm. Court figured the Turks assumed that the cameras, guns, gates, and staff protecting the property itself provided enough protection, and the internal structures didn't need to be overly secure. This bungalow was large enough for Court to consider entering here, somehow disabling the one security man he'd seen enter with his target, and then killing his target. It would have to be as quick and as quiet as possible, considering the fact that the 2-acre property was literally crawling with opposition. So while he would have loved nothing more than for Khan to suffer a demise as slow and as excruciating as it was overdue, he'd have to slit the man's throat, or, if unavoidable, just shoot him in the face with his suppressed Glock. He decided to go ahead with his plan, so anxious he was to kill this man, though he was seasoned enough to know his plan was riddled with holes. Copper was gone, and that meant his overhead recon on the disposition of the security forces was gone too. Goons could start raining down on him from all angles at any second, and he'd have no escape. But it didn't matter. The events of 12 years ago were as fresh in his mind as if they had happened just yesterday, and he was certain Murad Khan needed to be held accountable for his actions. Court knew he might well die tonight in the process of assassinating Khan, but as far as he was concerned, paying that price would be a bargain. Court rose at the window and began slowly pushing the wood-framed glass up, remaining perfectly silent as he did so. The lights were still off on the other side of the blinds. It was quiet around this part of the property, though he heard yelling and shouting off in the distance. Soon he had the window open high enough to climb through. He'd heard nothing to alert him to any danger, so he started to push the wooden blinds apart for a peek at the room he'd be entering. He reached for them, all his senses on fire now, and he almost had a hand on the blinds. Then the slats snapped open. He pulled his hand away, but he did not run. There, just 3 feet from his face and staring right back at him through the open blinds, was Murad Khan, former officer in the Foreign Coordination Unit of the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency of Pakistan. Khan was clearly as alarmed to see Court as Court was to see Khan. Court knew his own face telegraphed that he recognized the man in front of him, and he regretted this, but he cut himself some slack. Khan's face had been part of his nightmares for a dozen years now. He realized the man was standing alone in the dark little bathroom. He'd stepped up to piss in the toilet when he'd obviously heard the window a foot away from him slide open. The two men's eyes stayed locked on each other for a second more. But then, Quart's right hand shot down and grabbed his Glock. His plan was to jam the end of the silencer into the man's chest and shoot him through the heart at contact distance. And then Quart would run for his life. The pistol was rising up for the impossible-to-miss kill shot, but then a firearm cracked close off to Quart's right, and he felt a round streak right in front of his nose, impacting the trees to his left somewhere. Another shot sent Quart spinning in the direction of the gunfire, and aiming at the shooter now, he squeezed off two quick rounds. A man at the northeast corner of Bungalow 2 dropped his pistol and grabbed at his thigh before falling back behind the wall and out of Quart's view. The American now swung his weapon back to the open window, inches from his face. Khan was gone, clear of Quart's field of fire. Another gunshot boomed off to his right, this one hitting the wall near the window and peppering Quart's face with brick and plaster. The American turned and ran into the trees on the east, racing towards the perimeter fence in the darkness, cussing aloud at the situation he'd put himself in, and at the fact that he'd achieved nothing at all tonight other than learning one thing. Not only had he failed tonight, he'd failed long ago as well. Copper grabbed all the clothing strewn around her bedroom and threw it into a rolling suitcase. After zipping it shut and leaving it on the bed, she tossed the toiletries arrayed around her messy bathroom into her shoulder bag, and this too she threw on the bed. She rushed back to her computers to check the status of the UAV and saw that it was just coming to a hover above her hotel. As she watched the onboard camera on her monitor, the aircraft began lowering from 200 meters down to her balcony. She couldn't power off her equipment until she recovered it, so she ran back to the bedroom, grabbed her suitcase and her handbag, and brought them back out, placing them at the front door. Just as she headed again back to the computers, her wireless headset came alive in her ear. She had forgotten she was still wearing it.
Cobalt for Copper, are you still up on this net?
It was the American asset, the man who went off mission and destroyed this entire operation. She snapped at him.
I am shutting down and leaving. Why are you even contacting me?
Just checking in. Are you okay?
I will be better when I stop talking to you. Are you still in the compound?
No, I'm clear. Back out on the street and a couple blocks away.
After a pause, he said,
Listen, that thing I said I was going to do, it didn't happen, so you can relax about that. Still, you need to get out of wherever you are. There are some dangerous people involved in all this.
Really? Well, I think I'm talking to one of them right now, aren't I?
Fair point. What about the UAV?
It is descending above my location now. I was just about to land it and pack it up.
Her eyes looked up to the monitor to check the camera feed, and she saw that it was down to 40 meters and descending on course. The American said,
Something tipped off the security to some trouble. I don't know what it was.
Well, don't blame me. Maybe if you had stayed on mission, this wouldn't have happened. As I said, it would be impossible to track my UAV without...
She stopped talking when she saw something on the camera feed that confused her. Quickly, she tapped a button that stopped the drone's descent, just 35 meters now from landing. The man on the other end of the connection noted her sudden silence.
Copper, you there? Something wrong?
Softly, almost in a whisper, she said,
The black Mercedes from the embassy.
What about it?
It is... I don't understand this.
Talk to me, Copper.
It's parked outside my suite, just below the balcony.
Shit, the man said. Shit!
I don't understand. How could they know where I am?
Where are you?
She hesitated. Cobalt was not supposed to know her location, but the terror of realizing she'd been identified and fixed by the enemy overpowered her desire to remain beholden to her orders or her operational security.
I am at the Hotel El Jazer. It's only 5 minutes from the embassy.
They tracked your drone somehow.
And then, for a third time, the man shouted,
Shit!
How could they possibly...
It doesn't matter. They are there, and you are going to have to deal with it. Listen very carefully to me. You won't be able to get away. They will take you.
What? No! Take me where?
They will want to know who you are, what you know. That means they won't kill you. I need you to do something for me.
What?
Do you have another little stick-on GPS tracker like the one I was given?
Copper turned and looked at one of her backpacks.
Yes.
What's the battery life?
30 hours. Why?
Hide it on your body. Now!
I will track you wherever they take you, and I will get you back. You're going to have to hurry. Her mind raced. She felt lightheaded, nauseous.
You need my phone to see the tracking information.
Damn, they won't leave your phone behind. She looked down to her wrist.
My smartwatch. You can read the tracker location from the smartwatch.
That's it, then. Hide it in the bathroom, under the vanity, around the plumbing. I'll find it. What room?
Suite 211.
I'm on the way, but I won't get to you as fast as they will. Copper heard rushed footsteps in the hallway just outside her room, men running.
They are here. I can jump from the balcony and...
They are too smart for that. They will have a man in that car, and he will get you. Do what I said to do, and I will get you back. There was a quick pause. Then, I promise. She yanked off her headset, grabbed a tracker from the backpack, and ran into the bathroom. She took off the cover over the adhesive and placed the small, flat, cylindrical device high on the back of her neck, then took out her ponytail so it was hidden by her dark hair, and she pulled off her watch. Outside the suite, she heard a violent bang against the door. They weren't knocking on it. They were breaking it down. Looking around, panic welling inside her, she opened up the cabinet below the vanity, then placed the smartwatch in the joint in the plumbing, making it impossible to see unless someone got down on the floor and looked up for it. She hoped the American was smart enough to find it, because she only had time to step back into the living room of the suite before the door to the hallway crashed open. She stood there next to all her surveillance equipment. Her UAV had landed on the balcony, and the backup drone rested on the charging station next to it. She had been caught as red-handed as one could be. She expected the men who filed into the room to be Pakistani or Turkish, perhaps even Algerians who worked at the embassy, so she was surprised and confused when the first man approached her and spoke.
Tum kaun ho?
Who are you? It was Hindi, the woman's native language. She stammered but did not answer. The man said,
Tum kis kili kam karahi ho?
Who are you working for? An Indian, here, working for Pakistanis? She tried to figure it out. But not for long, because another man stepped up without speaking and swept a powerful backhand across her face. She fell to the ground, clutched at her battered jaw, and fought back tears of both pain and terror. The man who struck her turned to the others in the room and spoke in Urdu. Copper knew a little of the language. She'd studied it at university, but she didn't understand what the man said. Two men reached down and grabbed her, yanked her to her feet, while others rushed towards the desk full of computers and began grabbing equipment. 7. 12 years ago. The long rectangular table at the center of the well-lit space was surrounded by men and women who turned Matthew Hanley's way when he entered the sterile conference room. And this made him uncomfortable. The 7th floor of the CIA's McLean, Virginia headquarters held that kind of vibe for a man who, just 3 days prior, had been running lethal operations from an agency outpost in eastern Afghanistan. He didn't have friends here at HQ, though he saw faces he recognized. He nodded at no one in particular, then found an open chair halfway down the table on the right. Once seated, he felt enveloped by the strange quiet, and he looked around more carefully. There were 11 at the table plus himself, and all were silent, even though the meeting had not yet begun.
Fun crowd, Hanley thought.
Hanley had done stints working at headquarters, but not many, and not in a long time. He was a field man. He'd been with the Directorate of Operations and the National Clandestine Service since leaving the military nearly 15 years prior. He was in his mid-40s now, and he had served as a case officer in 4 countries before being moved over into the Special Activities Division, where he now worked as a group chief leading a combined ground branch and intelligence task force composed of 2 teams, Golf Sierra and Lima Foxtrot. Lima Foxtrot was still over in Afghanistan, along with the SAD intelligence cell under Hanley's command, but he'd brought Golf Sierra back to the States with him, so the 5 surviving men could bury their fallen teammate and get to work on finding and training up a replacement for him. To this end, Matt had some ideas, and he planned on discussing them just as soon as this meeting was called to order. He scanned the table around him. It was, at first glance, nothing but mid- and high-level executives from different departments, and he felt like the only outlier in the bunch. Men and women from the Special Activities Division, from Legal, from Personnel, and from the DO, which ran both SAD and other All Operations Divisions. Max Ohlhauser, from Legal, along with a deputy, a kid who didn't look 25 and dressed like he'd been on his way to a GQ photo shoot when yanked into the meeting, sat across from him. Gray-haired Jordan Mays, the assistant deputy director of SAD, sat next to the empty chair at the head of the table on Hanley's left. Looking down the table, however, Hanley saw one man he did not recognize. He sat at the far end, across and down from Hanley, and he looked as out of place as Hanley felt. The man wore his rumpled gray suit like it both pained and angered him to do so. His thinning curly hair was only perfunctorily combed, as if it had been done in a cab on the way here. He was past 60 and rough-looking, and he doodled on a pad of paper in front of him while eyeing all the others in the room, Matt Hanley included. Matt Hanley especially, in fact. Hanley had been at this long enough to know that this guy was operations, and old school, very old school. There was no way he was any kind of an exec. He looked and acted foreign here at HQ, even more so than Hanley himself, and he was way too battle-hardened and weather-worn to be in analysis or science and technology. He was a grizzled old spook. Normally a man like that, at that age, would have been put out to pasture, so Hanley wondered if he was part of the training cadre at the farm or one of the other CIA facilities. If so, he couldn't imagine what the hell the man was doing here for this meeting about a dead ground branch operator in Pakistan. Maurice Cahill wondered what the hell he was doing here for this meeting about a dead ground branch operator in Pakistan. He wasn't ground branch, he hadn't trained the man, and he didn't know anything about what happened to him because he wasn't read in on the op, other than the fact that the man died and a hellfire was launched in Pakistan. It sounded like a shit show, but it wasn't Maurice's shit show, so he couldn't imagine what any of this could possibly have to do with him. Nevertheless, he'd received the order the afternoon before to put on a monkey suit, come to HQ, and plop his ass in this conference room at this time, so here he was. As he looked around the room, he saw Mays, Ohlhauser, and Ohlhauser's pretty boy number two, whatever the fuck his name was. Athena Barrett from Personnel was here. DeFalco, deputy director for operations, sat morosely, probably because SAD was the red-headed stepchild of DO, and another dead operator, along with a hasty drone strike, meant headaches for the DDO. Yes, just as Maurice had expected, the table was filled with the usual suspects for a dry and inconsequential meeting on the seventh floor. These weren't the men and women who actually did the work at the agency. These were the men and women who talked about those who did the work at the agency. But then Maurice saw Matt Hanley. Maurice knew Hanley, though only by reputation. An ex-Green Beret, then a move to the agency, a meteoric rise as a case officer working rough stations, then a sideways shuffle into the Special Activities Division at the vanguard of the global war on terror. Maurice had heard that Hanley was a royal prick, but also damn good at his job. Not a man you'd want watching your back when it came to office politics, but exactly the man you'd want watching your back out in the field. The agency needed men like Hanley, Maurice told himself. He just didn't want to know him.
Well, Maurice thought, at least Hanley's a doer and not a talker like the rest of this pretentious bunch.
The older man doodled on his pad, wishing this meeting would hurry up and get going already, because he wanted to get out of HQ before he started to smell like the rest of the starched shirts around him. Mercifully, the door beyond the far end of the table opened, and a man in his 50s entered. Denny Carmichael was the head of the SAD, himself former military, having reached the rank of lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. Carmichael didn't smile, didn't acknowledge anyone at the table. He just sat down, took some papers from Mays on his left, and then looked up at the room. His eyes almost immediately locked on Hanley's, and Maurice knew this was about to get ugly. Hanley saw his boss glare across the table at him, and he knew this was about to get ugly. Carmichael said,
Matt, we meet again under the same circumstances as 4 months ago. Another fatality on your task force.
Yes, sir.
And this time, to top it off,
We shoved a Hellfire missile up the ass of a pickup truck with two nobodies inside. That, as you know, makes deniability of our operation a hard sell to the Pakistanis. State and the White House are running Greg DeFalco and me through the fucking coals.
He motioned to DeFalco, who didn't even look up from his briefing papers. Hanley took a slow breath.
My men were attempting to recover their teammate, and the decision was made to engage the technical and guard tower with the Hellfire in order to...
Carmichael waved a hand in the air and interrupted.
How'd you lose another man, Matt? What's the story this time?
Carmichael didn't wait for the response.
I read the after-action report. Six men dropped into a heavily defended compound. I guess we should count ourselves lucky your entire team wasn't wiped out.
Matt Hanley cleared his throat, glanced down at the opposite end of the table from Carmichael, and saw the old operations man he couldn't identify, looking at him with a stare that went right through him. He shook away the unease this caused and said,
Sir, our intel shop had been right on everything they had given us since we got to Forward Operating Base Chapman last month. We had solid information on the target location. All the overflights we needed were approved and carried out. We saw six guards on site, widely dispersed, plus the arrival of the man we thought to be an HVT with two security. We expected no more than nine enemy in total. But a tunnel had been constructed that led out of the compound. Somehow, infiltrators came into the location while we were conducting our search for the HVT. We presume the HVT used that same tunnel to escape.
So somebody knew you were coming. A leak in your operation, perhaps?
I don't see how. We certainly didn't inform the Pakistani authorities we were conducting a raid near Peshawar. This was ground branch, sir. Done in the black. If there was a compromise, it happened during the mission. A sentry the UAV didn't spot. Something like that.
Carmichael nodded, looked down at his papers.
The team, Gulf Sierra, they've been all the fuck over in the past year.
That's correct, sir. They have conducted more high-threat ops and taken more hits than any other team in Ground Branch, bar none.
You suffered two deaths along with a career-ending injury on the team, all in the last 6 months. You are certain your problem isn't with your number one?
Carmichael glanced at his notes again.
Hightower?
Hanley shook his head adamantly.
Absolutely positive about that, sir. Zach Hightower is former Navy Special Warfare, a DevGru operator. Decades of experience. He's a hard charger, no question, but that's exactly what we need. He's intelligent and careful without being carefree.
Carmichael looked around the room.
Other thoughts?
The young man with the slicked back hair sat directly across from Hanley. Hanley didn't recognize him, but he was seated next to Olhauser, the top lawyer for operations at CIA, so Hanley took the man to be part of the legal team. He said,
Why not stand down Gulf Sierra for a few months? Do a safety review. Ascertain if there are gaps we need to fill in the...
Carmichael shook his head.
We need them in the field and producing, especially now.
He turned back to Hanley.
The target of the mission was a deputy for the terrorist known as Pasha the Kashmiri. Did you recover anything of value about this Pasha guy or his organization?
Hanley cleared his throat uncomfortably.
Gulf Sierra captured a subject at the base. He claims he was security. Brought in for Major Omar Mufti's arrival that day. This man wasn't armed when we encountered him. We're guessing he tossed his weapon to make a run for it. He doesn't know much, but he admits to being a member of the Kashmiri Resistance Front. He did confirm other intel that we've picked up on the KRF in the past few months. He says the KRF is planning... How did he phrase it?
Hanley looked to his own notes now.
Something the West has never had to deal with before.
Carmichael said,
Threats don't impress me.
Then he sighed.
What about our working theory that Pasha was military as well, just like his number two?
The prisoner claims to not know of anyone higher in the hierarchy than Major Mufti. The complexity of their raids, however, definitely lead us to believe the fighters are organized and well-trained, and that leads us to the conclusion that they are run by someone with military experience. Maybe that's just Mufti exerting his influence as second-in-command. Maybe that's Pasha himself.
Carmichael shook his head.
Mufti was a damn helo pilot. He's not organizing land raids and rocket attacks against American outposts.
Hanley acquiesced with a shrug. Carmichael added,
I think Pasha is former military as well, a colonel, perhaps. If true, then he might well have dangerous contacts, and he might very well know a lot more about agency activities in Pakistan and Afghanistan than we want any terrorist knowing.
He thought for a moment, and then, with a nod, he said,
Gulf Sierra will stay on this. As soon as you replace the fallen paramilitary operations officer, I want you and them back over there. Let Lima Foxtrot fill the gap in the meantime.
Carmichael barked now.
And fix your damn intelligence section, Matt. You and I both have worked operations where we were sent into unknowns after the analysts claimed to know it all. I didn't like it when it was me, and I don't like it for Hightower and his men.
Yes, sir. I'm looking at replacing the analyst who failed.
He drummed his fingers on his notepad.
About replacing the paramilitary, though, I want to pick from ground branches best. I've brought a few names along who I think would be suitable for the...
Carmichael shook his head.
Disallowed. I have another idea. I've looked at your missions over the last year, and I'm looking at what's ahead for you and your boys going after Pasha in Pakistan. This is a marathon, not a sprint. I might need your team to infiltrate deeper into denied territory. Much deeper.
Warily, Hanley said.
Okay.
I have decided, then, that you need a different kind of operator on your team.
Hanley was instantly on guard now.
What do any of these suits know about what the hell Hightower needs out there in the mud and sand?
He controlled himself and asked,
What do you mean by that, sir?
Not just another shooter. You need someone with the ability to work on a team for kinetic actions, but also someone able to infiltrate a target.
Matt Hanley sniffed.
My boys did a hey-ho drop at 28,000 feet, Denny, landing on a rooftop 30 miles away. Gulf Sierra infiltrates targets just fine.
Carmichael shook his head.
I'm not talking about that type of infiltration. You need a man with real tradecraft. I want your new six to be a spook. A spook who can shoot.
My ground branch men aren't just trigger pullers. They have all the tradecraft skills they need to...
Your men are former DevGru or Delta or HRT guys who operate in teams. They have more tradecraft than military special operations forces, no argument there. But I'm talking about something else. Not a jack of both trades, but an ace of both trades. Both soldier and spy. That's what you need.
Hanley said,
In my experience here in operations, that man does not exist.
Suddenly, Hanley heard movement across the table. He turned to see the old man he didn't recognize sitting up straighter suddenly, putting his pen down, and then crossing his arms. Clearly he understood something about what Carmichael was saying, and clearly he didn't like it. Hanley, however, remained very much in the dark.
Sir,
Hanley said to Carmichael,
do you have someone in mind?
I do, but first I asked some people to come to this meeting who might have ideas of their own. I suspect their thoughts will coincide with mine.
He scanned the table.
The rest of you know details about code word ops using agency field assets. I want a name. A name of a man who might fit in on a rendition team, but a man who also excels at thinking outside the box. I need a man who can help Gulf Sierra conduct unconventional operations in and around Pakistan.
It was silent for a moment. Hanley looked around, unsure who would reply. To Hanley's surprise, the young man from legal was the first to speak. He said,
Sir?
Carmichael turned to him.
Lloyd?
You're talking about Violator.
Carmichael nodded.
I am indeed.
Hanley looked to the young man now.
What's Violator?
Lloyd said,
Not what, who. He did that thing in Murmansk a year or so ago.
There were 12 at the table in total. Hanley noticed that only a few nodded in understanding.
I agree,
DeFalco from Operations said.
That took incredible tradecraft, staying in deep cover like that for so long, and it obviously also took a lot of martial ability. There was a significant body count at the end of it, if you remember.
Hanley couldn't believe what he was hearing. He knew some details of the operation in the port city of Murmansk in northwestern Russia, but it was code-worded, and not an SAD initiative, so he didn't know much.
The Moormansk operation. Are you suggesting that was accomplished by only one asset?
Carmichael nodded at this.
Affirmative.
It was clear to Hanley that this was the exact same asset Carmichael himself had been thinking about. Hanley then asked,
And he's ours?
He's in the DO, yes,
DeFalco confirmed.
Okay, Hanley said, sitting back in his chair now. You have my attention.
Carmichael turned to look down the table now. Hanley followed his eyes, didn't know which of the two men and one woman sitting there was going to speak. When no one did, he looked back to Carmichael. Hanley took the floor again.
Sir, Gulf Sierra is getting more hits, more high-threat, high-impact raids than anyone else in Ground Branch. I'd put their activity level up against anyone at JSOC, and I can guarantee the complexity of their work is more than anything the Army or Navy is doing. Whoever this asset is, I need to at least take a look at him for myself, to put him with Hightower and the rest of the team and see if we can work him in.
Carmichael kept his eyes on the far end of the table while he addressed Hanley. Now it was clear that the head of the Special Activities Division was staring at the older man in the rumpled gray suit. Carmichael said,
The asset who conducted the Moormansk operation, alone, is codenamed Violator. Maurice Cahill built him, quite literally from the ground up.
Matt Hanley spun his head to the right, stared at the older man.
So this is the infamous Maurice.
He didn't know Cahill personally, but he knew the man's reputation.
Holy shit, Hanley thought. This old bastard is a living legend.
Cahill hadn't said a word during the meeting, but now he spoke up. His voice was raspy, like these were the first words he'd uttered today, this week even.
Violator is not a good fit for a rendition team, Denny. But he's in cover right now, on a national security directive, and he's in a role he knows. We should leave him right there.
Hanley spoke up now, intrigued.
Can he shoot? Is he paramilitary?
Maurice brought his shoulders back a little.
He has overlapping skill sets with the type of work Ground Branch does, I won't deny that. But that's not the point. The point is, he's needed exactly where he is to—
Carmichael interrupted.
I'll determine where he's needed, Maurice. You trained him, you know him. Do you think he could integrate with the rendition task force if called upon to do so?
Maurice shrugged.
He's done every last thing we've ever asked of him. I don't see why he couldn't run and gun with some team of Ground Branch doorkickers, but that's not where his true abilities lie. He's a force multiplier, not a point man on a kill squad. He needs to be...
Carmichael turned to Hanley, ignoring Maurice.
You want him?
Hanley said. I want to see his file, at least.
To this, Carmichael answered flatly.
Denied. He was hired into the agency in a Sub Rosa program that is not in your purview. Not in the purview of anyone in this room except for Mays, Max Olhauser, Greg DeFalco, and myself.
Jordan Mays took the opportunity to say,
I think, sir, considering what Matt and Gulf Sierra have been doing in the past year, and considering what we'll likely need from them in the near term on the hunt for Pasha the Kashmiri, Violator would be a perfect fit.
Maurice spoke up again, imploringly this time.
Look, Denny, not this one, not this asset. Please, find somebody else.
Carmichael stared him down.
You sound like an overprotective parent.
I'm the one man in the room who knows the man's competencies. He's been run ragged. Let's save him for when we really need him.
Mr. Cahill,
Hanley spoke up now.
If he did Moormansk alone, then I know his competencies too. A little bit about them anyway. That was an incredible display of just exactly the skills my team needs. I want him, even if I can't read his file.
Carmichael whispered to Mays for several seconds. The rest of the room remained quiet. Finally, he looked again down the table at Maurice.
Violator will be reassigned to Ground Branch. He'll be the new six on Gulf Sierra.
He turned to the woman from personnel.
You can make it happen, Athena.
The head of personnel said,
If someone brings him in from the cold, I can paper him into Ground Branch
A regular SAD paramilitary operations officer.
She shrugged.
No big deal.
The head of SAD looked to Maurice now. Maurice's face showed displeasure, as much as Hanley had ever seen anyone show their displeasure in a seventh-floor meeting with a senior exec, but the old man at least held his tongue.
"Where is he?"
Carmichael asked. Maurice answered,
"I don't know."
Jordan Mays said, "I checked this morning. He is in Belarus currently, temporarily on stand-down. He checks in from time to time. We don't have a direct line to him." This sounded weird to Hanley, but Hanley didn't know anything about this Sub Rosa program, so he didn't question it. Carmichael did not hesitate.
"Maurice, I want you to go personally to pull him out and bring him back here. Explain to him why this is in his best interest." "First, Denny, you'd better explain to me why it's in his best interest."
"You will have my everlasting appreciation."
"And if he refuses?"
"Get him here. Tell him he can always return to his former tasks if he can't hack it in Ground Branch."
Carmichael's craggy, thin, and stern face formed a sinister smile. "I know men like him. He'll see that as a personal challenge." Maurice did not respond to this, nor did he hide his displeasure. He stood, though the meeting had not been adjourned. When everyone turned his way at what they all took to be a show of disrespect, Maurice just addressed Carmichael.
"I assume, Denny, that neither you nor Mr. Hanley here want me to delay a moment when I could be back in my office booking a flight to Minsk."
Carmichael smiled the smile of a weary parent to his recalcitrant child.
"Go, Maurice."
The older man headed for the door, and Hanley realized he was going to get a new six for Hightower, and he wouldn't be able to tell Hightower a thing about the man before they met. Zack would not be pleased. Denny Carmichael walked alone along the seventh-floor hallway back to his office. He'd just arrived in his outer lobby when he saw Maurice sitting there waiting for him. A glance at his executive assistant and a shake of her head confirmed to him that she'd not given the older man any assurances he was going to get an audience. There was a protocol to arranging a meeting with a seventh-floor exec, but this was Maurice, and he'd been flouting the rules at CIA for as long as Denny Carmichael could remember. He didn't break stride when he saw the older man sitting there. He kept heading for the door to his office, but he said,
"Had a feeling you weren't rushing out to book a flight."
Maurice stood.
"I need to talk to you about this, one-on-one."
Carmichael waved him in behind him, then looked at his EA.
"Rachel, I need 5 minutes, no more."
"Yes, sir."
Carmichael closed the door behind Maurice, went to his desk, and put his folio down.
"You can make your case. It won't change a thing, but I don't want you saying I wouldn't even listen to you, bitch. Denny, you, more than anyone else, know what the men in the Autonomous Asset Program have accomplished in the last few years. And Violator is the best of the bunch."
Denny sat down behind his desk. Maurice sat in front of him, though he'd not been invited to do so.
"This HVT, Pasha. He's intertwined, somehow, with the political and intelligence fabric of Pakistan. He's not some mooj in a cave wearing man jammies. What's it going to take to bring him down? We aren't talking about smash and grab stuff anymore. This is real espionage, but espionage that will end with bullets cracking foreheads. Violator is exactly what a small ground branch cell tasked with infiltrating Pakistan to terminate a protected HVT needs. Violator doesn't know Pakistan. He doesn't... The program he's in, the program we built, was designed to create assets who could go anywhere, melt into the landscape, and get jobs done. Right now, I don't need that in Russia one-tenth as much as I need it in Pakistan." "Then why not send him in as part of an autonomous initiative? Why does he have to be folded into a ground branch operation? Hanley's in command of the hunt for Pasha, not Islamabad Station. Ted Appleton's doing a damn good job running the station in Pakistan. He gets incredible intelligence product from his sources, but he's not a killer. He's always looking for a political solution with the PACs, and there is no political solution that can eradicate a terror organization the size and scope of the resistance front, especially if they've infiltrated the military. This is a job for SAD, and front and center in that fight will be Hanley and his gunmen.
We need hard men who can suppress and then exploit targets in a denied area. And for that, I need Ground Branch. I also need more surveillance skills, B&E skills, black bag skills, social engineering skills, all the shit you taught Violator. Gulf Sierra will be a formidable unit if you can get your boy to comply.
Denny continued.
Shit, Maurice. I've read every word of his file. He's a ghost. He can shoot. He can fly aircraft. He can pilot boats. He speaks three languages. He can work deep cover. He can...
I know what he can do, Denny. I just don't see him doing it with five other guys. They'll only slow him down.
Carmichael laughed angrily.
Gulf Sierra is more tip of the spear than that oddball of yours hiding out in Belarus. I can assure you of that.
Before Maurice could reply, Denny said,
Get out of my office. Go get Violator. Bring him in from the cold.
Maurice stood, but Denny added,
But first, old man, take a good look around at the seventh floor, because this is the last time you'll ever be anywhere near it.
Maurice Cahill nodded wearily.
Suits me just fine. You used to be a field man, Denny, but I have to say, I can hardly recognize you here in your three grand suit and your master plan to move pieces on a chessboard you don't even understand.
Carmichael picked up some papers on his desk and made a show of reading them. After just a few seconds, he looked up.
You and I are both military men, Maurice. Different generations, but whatever. I am your superior officer. Right now, your job is to roger up, turn around, walk out that door, and execute your orders. Have you forgotten how all that works?
Denny looked down at the papers again. Maurice stood there, unmoving. Carmichael looked back up at him slowly.
Are you still here?
This time, Maurice turned and left without another word.
8. Present day. Court's rented Honda Fit subcompact raced the winding and hilly streets of Algiers, arriving at the Hotel El Jazer less than 10 minutes after his reconnaissance technician, the woman he only knew as Copper, last spoke to him from there. He expected her, and her captors, to be long gone by now, but he took no chances. He accessed the suite from the balcony, climbing a drain pipe and then kicking his leg over the waist-high wrought iron rail. Two tiny UAV chargers sat on the balcony, but the drones they charged were missing. He saw that the sliding door to the suite was ajar, so he entered the living room and cleared the space with his pistol quickly, though he was pretty sure he knew what he'd find. This was not the first time in his career he'd shown up too late, and it was always like this. A broken chair, a ransacked room, equipment and luggage strewn in all directions. Cords sticking out of walls but no longer attached to the laptops or other electronics they had once powered. He bypassed all the mess for now, swept the bedroom and the bathroom and the closets with his weapon to make sure no one had been left behind. Only when he was done with this did he return to the bathroom and kneel down below the vanity. He fished around for a moment, then found the watch Copper had hidden by setting it on the S-turn on the drainpipe. Looking it over, he saw that the woman had activated the tracker app, and he could easily make out her position as a blinking green dot that moved along a tiny display. He didn't take time to see where she was going. He'd do that later. Instead, he ran to the balcony, looked over the side to make sure no one was down there in a little alleyway that ran between two sections of the hotel, then climbed off it, dropping down the last few feet. 5 minutes later, he was back in his white Honda, driving through the nighttime streets of Algiers, desperately trying to identify where the little blip on the watch was heading. He could tell it was moving east, and this was bad news. The airport was east, and he was at least 20 minutes behind them and not making up any ground, since at this time of night he knew better than to flout the city's traffic laws. He was still carrying a pistol, after all. He told himself to ignore the watch for the next few minutes, to concentrate on driving towards the airport, and to make a call. The man Court knew as Arjun answered quickly. In his earlier conversations over the phone with his new broker, Court picked up on the fact that the man was clearly Indian, and he spoke English in a somewhat aristocratic British way that Court suspected might have been a put-on.
Yes?
Arjun was breathless when he answered, nervous and not even trying to hide it.
Court, in contrast, spoke calmly and methodically.
The operation failed. The technical asset has been kidnapped by the opposition. I have a low-profile tracker on her, and I'm in pursuit, but I think they are heading to the airport. I might not be able to retrieve her before they fly her out of the country.
Admittedly, this was a lot of information to take in, and a full serving of bad news. But when the man did not reply after several seconds, Court's frustration grew.
Are you there? Did you hear me?
She's been kidnapped?
The Pakistanis must have traced her UAV's origin. They sent men.
Now the man shouted.
Of course they did! They sent men because you decided to assassinate someone!
That's not why they came for her. I didn't kill anyone. They were on the way to pick her up before I'd even been identified on the property.
Where are they taking her?
I don't know. That little GPS tracker won't work on an aircraft, but assuming they fly her somewhere and assuming they don't find the tracker en route, I should be able to see her on the app wherever she lands.
These men, what will they do to her?
There was a pain in his voice. He seemed to Court to be uniquely concerned about his employee.
They will keep her alive, for now, but these are bad people.
The ISI? Yes, they are bad people, but this isn't that type of a mission. You are the only one with murder on his mind!
Court gripped the steering wheel and thought about what to say next. He made the decision to level with his broker.
I don't know who you are, but I can guess. You are obviously Indian. I don't think you are with their intelligence services presently, but my guess is the research and analysis wing is using you for this op to keep their hands clean with Turkey. How am I doing so far?
None of that matters. Copper is our priority now.
It does matter, Court countered. Because whoever you are, I'm going to assume you have some knowledge of intelligence matters yourself. Specifically, knowledge of Pakistani intelligence. More specifically, about events in the past.
Arjun hesitated. He was obviously confused by what his American asset was trying to tell him. But then he said,
Go on.
Tonight I saw someone at the Turkish embassy, and if you know anything about the past, you will know why I tried to kill him, right then and there.
Arjun said nothing, and Court continued.
The man who arrived for the meeting tonight was Murad Khan. Don't even pretend not to know who.
That's bloody impossible! You've made a mistake. There is no way you could've...
Trust me, Arjun. I'd know that face anywhere. I was 1 meter from the tip of his nose, and it was him.
But it can't be. He died 10 years ago.
Almost 12,
Court corrected, and then he amended himself. Except he didn't really seem all that dead when I bumped into him a few minutes ago. Arjun wasn't having it.
The Americans killed him. Everyone knows what happened.
I don't know what to tell you, Chief. He's alive, and his people have copper. I'll help you get her back. But if I'm going to do that, I'm going to need a lot out of you.
Court drove along in silence while his broker thought it over. Finally, Arjun said,
If it was Khan, if it really was him, then I need to notify authorities in New Delhi.
Not till we know where the woman is. He saw me. He doesn't know me, but he had to have seen that I recognized him. That will buy her some time. They will need to try to find out who I am, who I'm working for. Who I might tell. Their unknowns in this are our leverage. But if it gets out wide that he's been seen alive, we won't have that leverage anymore. And then they'll kill her.
The man from India spoke in a soft lament.
This was supposed to be easy. No great danger. Just a simple mission.
Believe me, I hear that shit all the time.
A mission to intercept counterfeiting ink coming in from Switzerland. That's all. The Pakistanis were in Algeria working on an operation to produce counterfeit rupees, to insert them into India and affect the economy. It was a malicious operation, of course, but it is not. It's not murder.
Court hadn't known why he was sent to plant the IMSI catcher at the Turkish embassy for the meeting between the Pakistani and the Swiss national. But he was surprised to learn it had to do with counterfeiting rupees. That seemed too small for Murad Khan. If history was to be any guide, Khan was up to another play. Court put that thought out of his mind.
Can we work together on this? We get the woman back, then you can go to the Indian government about Khan.
Why won't you go to the American government?
Because I'm not with the American government.
I'm not with the Indian.
Trust me, Court interrupted. Whatever your relationship with your people is, it's better than my relationship with my people.
Very well. If you are right, if this is Khan, then we must hurry. You must find Copper. There is nothing this man would not do to protect his identity now, after what he did 12 years ago.
Yeah, Court muttered. Tell me about it. The American held the Apple Watch up to his face as he drove and saw that the blip representing Copper was now stationary. As he feared, the men had taken her to the airport. They were far from the terminal, so he assumed there would be a private plane there on the tarmac. He was 20 minutes behind still, and he saw no chance whatsoever that he could get there, get onto the airport grounds, locate Copper, and then get her away from a group of men before they managed to take off.
Shit,
he said to himself. He'd have to find a flight himself, but he did not know where to go. If the men who held Copper took her to Pakistan, as he feared, he'd have to find a way in. But he wasn't about to just climb aboard a domestic flight to Karachi right now. No. He'd go somewhere in that direction and prepare the next phase of his mission, which had already crept far out of control. Court hung up the phone and continued on through the night towards another airport, towards another journey, towards another foreign country and another kidnap victim and another group of assholes who so richly deserved to die. This was his life. But he wasn't thinking about any of this now. He was thinking about the past. It occurred to him that he had never stopped thinking about the past. 9. 12 years ago. Slonim, Belarus was a quiet city with a population just under 50,000, roughly an hour's drive east of the Polish border. It was off the tourist beat, even by the minimal standards of Belarus, a mill, factory, and timber town surrounded by fields and forests, intersected by rivers and highways. The Skara River runs north to south through the center of town, and just on the western bank, a barren construction site stood far enough away from the lights of the rows of apartment buildings nearby to be pitch black in the night. Parichnaya Road passed along the western side of the property. A chain-link fence separated it from the building site. The road was empty of vehicular traffic at this time of the evening, and only a single pedestrian walked through the dark, his silhouette disrupted by his hooded jacket and his backpack. With his hands in his pockets, he looked, if there had been anyone around to see him at all, as if he were heading north towards a quiet neighborhood of small apartment buildings just a few hundred meters away. But as he reached the edge of the property, he abruptly turned right, leapt up on the chain-link fence, and climbed it deftly and without any obvious concern that someone might be watching. He moved like he belonged, like he did this every damn night, and it was no big deal. He dropped down on the other side onto a pile of earth, then made his way to asphalt that had been recently poured and leveled for a parking lot. Here, he pulled off his backpack and dropped it on the ground, then took off his coat and dropped it as well. Under it, he wore a dark green fleece jacket with a hood, blue jeans, and black running shoes. He stopped, listened, and waited for a full minute in the black. Cortland Gentry was 25 years old and an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, operating under the code name Violator. He was a non-official cover officer, meaning if he were captured here or anywhere for that matter, he could be subjected to a long imprisonment or worse. Much worse. His personal security was important to him, so he stood here in the dark, ears tuned to any hint he'd been discovered. Finally, he convinced himself he'd not been detected, so he unzipped his backpack and pushed his hand down into it, rummaging past a collection of small empty tin cans, reaching around a medical kit and a plastic bag and a bottle of water, before finally retrieving the largest item in the pack. He stood back up with a set of night vision goggles, attached to tactical headgear, slipped the device over his head, adjusted the chin strap tightly, and then lowered the two image intensifier tubes down in front of his eyes. He turned on the device, and the near pitch black darkness shifted into a hazy green as the tubes took in the tiny bit of ambient light from the stars above the cloud cover.
In front of him on the construction site, he saw what he knew he would see, what he'd seen most every night for the past week. A three-story skeletonized building. The exterior walls were open to the elements, but the floors, stairwells, and inner weight-bearing beams were in place, as was some of the interior wallboard, the plumbing, and the electrical wiring. Cort figured this would be a big, ugly office building someday soon. Leaving his coat on the asphalt but picking up his pack, he zipped it shut and put it back on his back, then took off through the construction site at a jog, heading for the building. An hour later, Cort Gentry sat on the rooftop of the construction site, looking down at the Black River through his NODs, and eating from a bag of granola with dried cherries he'd bought at the produce market that afternoon. His heart was still beating hard, his muscles sore. He'd been training in parkour. He'd jumped, vaulted, dropped, run, and rolled all over this building. He had a high-quality pellet gun on his hip, right in front of his real firearm, and he'd used the pellet gun to shoot targets while on the move, adding difficulty to the already complex art of free-running. At one point, he'd failed to get one of his legs up high enough during a monkey vault over an iron water pipe, and this had sent him tumbling awkwardly onto his right arm. He rubbed his elbow, thinking of his mistake. It would be fine in a day or two, he knew, and it took his focus off last night's shoulder injury. Overall, however, he felt better tonight about his performance than he had on the other evenings he'd come here to train. Training was tough work, but this type of disciplined practice was so ingrained in the young man that it was an integral part of his life. The man who taught him everything about spycraft a few years earlier had a saying that played in Cort's mind every day.
Stay ready so you don't have to get ready.
Cort Gentry did everything he could to stay ready, because his country needed him. The American had been living here in sleepy Slonim for the past month, lying low after doing a job down south in Kharkiv, Ukraine, near the Russian border. The mission had been the political assassination of the separatist hitman who'd killed a high-level Ukrainian diplomat, a politician the United States had put a lot of hope and resources into. Cort had pulled it off. He'd quickly and cleanly killed the killer, and then he'd come here to hide out before returning to his home base in Moscow. Gentry worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, but there existed not a single document proving that in his possession. He was a singleton, a lone operator, employed in a sub-Rosa outfit known only to a few at Langley as the Autonomous Asset Program. Cort had been at this for nearly 4 years now, and he'd conducted dozens of operations in the field. Cort was always in the field. And now, years after he'd been recruited, he found himself alone in a foreign land, waiting for his next operation, waiting for someone else to kill. He climbed to his feet, just on the edge of the roof of the construction site, wiped the granola off his hands, and rubbed his sore elbow as he headed back for the stairs, ready to begin the drive home to his apartment. 10. Present day. Priyanka Bhandari didn't know where she was exactly, but she had a feeling she knew where she was going. If she wasn't heading to some dungeon in Islamabad or Quetta or Karachi, then she couldn't imagine where else they could possibly be taking her. When they kidnapped her from her hotel suite, headphones were immediately placed over her ears. Music blared at a volume that made it impossible to hear anything going on around her, and a pillowcase from her bed was pulled over her head. She was led to a waiting car, and though she hadn't been bound in any way, she could feel men seated on either side of her, pressing up against her, and this, along with the sensory deprivation of the hood and the music, was more than enough incentive for her to behave herself on the drive through Algiers. Priyanka wasn't a fighter. She wasn't a spy, or an agent, or a soldier, or anything of the like. In fact, up until 4 months earlier, she'd been primarily a college student. This was the first real full-time job she'd ever had in her life, only her second time out in the field, and it had somehow led to all this. After a half-hour's drive, she'd been led out of the car, and through the music, she felt the vibration of jet engines on her right. Then she'd been escorted roughly up jet stairs, and panic welled within her as a hand was placed on the back of her head so that she didn't bump it, entering the cabin of what seemed to be an executive jet. She'd placed the tracker high on the back of her neck, behind her flowing hair, and the hand that guided her briefly touched it, but apparently, both the pillowcase and her thick hair were enough buffer that he didn't recognize the outline of the little metal disc under his fingertips. She was pushed down roughly in the aircraft, and she felt it take off minutes later. Once the plane leveled, the headphones and pillowcase were removed, but all the cabin lights had been turned off, including the emergency lights, so she could see nothing around her. Four men spoke from different directions in the darkness, in Hindi, but with accents. They asked her name over and over, and she refused to answer, as if she did not understand. They asked her who she was working for, and she refused to answer. They asked her what she knew, and she refused to answer this either. They tried speaking to her in English, but she did not respond. Most educated Indians of her age would likely know at least some English, but she played dumb, desperate to think of some strategy to extricate herself from this situation. She was so new to this world. She didn't even know she was in this world until things had gone so terribly wrong tonight. She thought she was just a technician working semi-remotely to assist an operation that was for the benefit of her nation. When the men in the cabin made no headway with her after 5 minutes, one of them moved closer, wrapped his fingers around her throat, and squeezed firmly. Priya brought her hands up to his, tried to pull them away, but the man was just too strong. This man spoke to her in Hindi, but he sounded Indian, not Pakistani like the others. She realized it was the same man who'd addressed her in the suite back in Algiers.
"The person who entered the embassy tonight, he is all we care about. Unless you care about him more than your own life, you will tell us who he was."
She wasn't trained for this shit, and she knew in her heart that the minute they started playing hardball with her, she would crack. But the man close to her face did not play hardball, not yet. When she did not reply to him, he slowly released his grip. He leaned closer to her. He was almost visible in the darkness, but not quite.
"We've been told to take you someplace where we will have the time and the tools to extract whatever we want from you. You will regret not having a pleasant conversation with me now. I can promise you that."
The woman said nothing, though her stomach roiled with panic. She believed every word the man said, but she knew she had to fight the urge to simply blurt out everything she knew.
"Very well, young lady. Relax for now. Enjoy the flight. The true unpleasantness will begin when we land."
The headphones were snapped back on her ears, and the hood was returned to her head. 11. 12 years ago. Court Gentry returned to his apartment building from his late-night training shortly before 2 a.m. He kept his thoughts on his personal security, making certain he'd not been followed, keeping an eye out for anyone who didn't fit or any other discernible changes around his flat that would serve as an indicator of danger. He saw nothing amiss, took the stairs to his floor, and unlocked and opened his door slowly. He slid his fingers around the doorframe until he put his hand on a piece of thread he'd taped loosely to both the inside doorframe and the top of the door itself. It was still affixed, so he pushed the door open and stepped inside. Walking through his living room in the dim, he made certain the same single light was on as when he left, and he looked for footprints on a small shag carpet in the entryway. Satisfied his place was undisturbed, he went to his kitchen just off the living room. Here he put down his keys, took off his backpack, his ball cap, and his jacket, and opened the refrigerator. He reached into one of the cases of beer and retrieved a cold bottle, then popped the top with a handheld opener. He closed the fridge and casually faced his apartment. He drank a long, loud swig of beer and took in his surroundings with a bored sigh, then began heading towards the bedroom, drawing his pellet gun from his holster as he did so. This he placed on a table next to his TV, putting it down with the thud of a polymer and steel weapon being laid to rest. Then he carefully placed the beer down on the same table on a paperback so that it, in contrast to the gun, made no sound. He burped as he ambled lazily toward the bedroom, but when he stepped inside the darkened room, he went from moving with nonchalance to moving with astonishing speed and purpose. He spun around on his right foot as he reached under his shirt to his hip, dropped to a combat crouch, and aimed his 9mm handgun at the chair in the corner. A man sat there in the dark. It was quiet in the room, save for the sound of a streetcar outside. The man in the chair did not move a muscle. He faced the gun pointed at him, but he did not reel back in terror. Court spoke to the silhouette in Russian.
Katyote.
Who are you? His finger rested lightly on the trigger of his Walther PPQ. The seated man raised his hands in surrender, then reached even more slowly to the table next to him and pulled the cord on a small lamp there, bringing the corner into view with a click. A nearby empty bottle of beer sat on the table under the light. The man spoke English.
The thread on the door, the shag carpet. Did I miss a third telltale? Or was it the damn beer I snuck?
Court lowered his weapon.
The third telltale was the beer you snuck. Should have been 7 left in that case. I put my hand in and found 2 rows of 3.
I'll be damned,
the man said, and then he smiled.
I taught you well, didn't I?
I knew how to count to 7 before I met you, Maurice.
Court rose to his feet, slipped the Walther back into the waistband holster at his 4 o'clock position, went to retrieve his beer just inside the living room, and sat down on the bed. Maurice turned the light back off and remained seated there in the dark. He said,
It's been a while, kid. How you doing?
Fine.
Maurice looked around.
Nice place. Very nice. You aren't going soft, are you?
The younger man just stared back at him.
Where were you tonight?
Am I out past curfew?
Cute. You aren't running around with any women, are you?
Court looked at himself in the wall mirror next to where Maurice sat. His jeans and fleece were coated in the dust and lime of a construction site. His hands were scratched, and his beard still had bits of wallboard in it.
Not that kind of running around.
Training, then?
What did you always say? Never stop sharpening the blade.
Maurice nodded at this as he looked around at the apartment.
This place, too clean, too neat, too nice. Books on the shelves and paintings on the walls and a kick-ass stereo.
He motioned to the bed Court sat on.
Even a big fluffy bed. Slept in, left unmade. I turned you into a hard man, son. That's an important asset in this business. One you can't afford to lose. You think I'm the interior decorator here? I rented this place furnished. The books on the coffee table are mine, but the rest was here when I got here. You could have rented a barn.
Why would I rent a...
You should sleep in a fucking barn, kid. It would do you good.
You first.
The older man rolled his eyes.
Yeah, it was me first. I once went 3 days alone with a broken kneecap, without water, sleeping in the jungle and staying alive, drinking rainwater off of palm fronds while dodging Charlie.
Court turned his head and looked out the window at the cool night.
I sure have missed all your there I was and the shit stories about Vietnam.
Really?
Nope.
Court sipped his beer. Maurice chuckled a little.
That was in Laos anyway.
Right.
The older man reached into his jacket. Court's hand moved to the gun on his hip. He had it out in the blink of an eye. Maurice stopped.
Settle down, Roy Rogers. Just grabbing my Marlboros.
No smoking, Court said.
You'd shoot me if I lit up?
Court holstered the weapon, but he kept his hand on the grip.
Not to kill.
Maurice laughed a raspy laugh now, put his hands back in his lap.
Well, that's one way to quit, I guess.
Court put his own hands on his knees, but he said nothing. He was stiff, utterly on guard for whatever Maurice was here to tell him. The older man sensed the unease.
Listen. The 2 years we spent together, way back when, everything that happened, as tough as it was for you, it all needed to happen, every last bit of it, in order to make you into the asset you are today.
Don't patronize me, I know all that.
Maurice smiled.
Patronize? A $10 word. Those books in the front room aren't just to backstop your legend as a student, then.
I read a lot in my downtime. I've been reading for the past 4 years.
And studying Russian as well?
Court shrugged. Other languages, too, when I'm not working.
I've heard a little about your work. Murmansk, specifically. You did that, Colonel. I'm not read in on it, but I picked up some scuttlebutt. Sounded like some crazy shit went down.
Court shrugged at this. It didn't go down. It went sideways, he added. But the mission objectives were achieved. Maurice nodded.
They usually are with you, I hear. And the reason you've been so successful is due to what I put you through in training.
Flatly, Court said, you almost killed me. Multiple times.
Exactly. And that made you hard to kill,
Maurice added.
All that was out of love, not out of hate. Although I know how building somebody up can seem a lot like tearing somebody down when you are the one on the receiving end.
What are you trying to do, Maurice?
What do you mean?
I mean now. What are you doing? You came here to tell me I'm awesome and you're the one who made me that way? Look, I've already got a dad, and he's an even bigger asshole than you. So, if you're trying to be some kind of a father figure, you're wasting your time. The older American regarded the man seated on the bed for a long time.
What's wrong, son? I didn't expect a hug and a sloppy kiss, but you seem unhappy.
Court shook his head. No.
Angry, then?
No. The older man looked hard into the younger man's eyes. Finally, he said,
Different, anyway.
Now Court answered him.
The job. I thought it was going to be different. Different how? More fun?
Less lonely. Maurice regarded the comment for a moment, weighing his options for a response.
When we found you, you were in prison in Florida. I bet you weren't lonely there.
Court glared at him, then turned his gaze out the window once again. It was silent for nearly a minute. Court remembered that Maurice had no problem weathering pregnant pauses. Eventually, however, Maurice polished off his beer and held the empty bottle up in the dark.
Another round, barkeep?
A minute later, the two men sat on bar stools at the kitchen counter, each with a second bottle of Stavka in his hand. Court said,
You've never dropped in on me in the field, Maurice, and you sure as hell have never kissed my ass. What's this about?
To this, the older man sighed with a smile.
So much for small talk. Okay, kid, down to it. You are being recalled. Immediately.
Court put his beer down on the counter with a loud thunk.
What did I do? You did every last thing that's ever been asked of you, just as I knew you would. Now, the powers that be are asking something else of you. Where am I going?
Maurice grimaced a little, giving Court the impression that he wouldn't like what he was about to hear.
There's a SAD task force that suffered a casualty the other night. Your name was fielded as a replacement. You'd be a paramilitary operations officer in Ground Branch.
Ground Branch? Court was genuinely surprised.
But I'm a singleton. I haven't worked with anybody and, well, I've never worked with anybody. Yeah, this will take some getting used to. The rest of the team are all SEAL Team 6 or Delta, I'd imagine. You'll have to show them that you do know how to run and gun with the squad. You have the background for it. You just might be a little rusty. They'll fix you up.
When you say they had a casualty, I'm gonna guess the officer is KIA.
That's correct.
Court was unfazed by this news. Why do they want me?
They are getting some tough hits, dynamic work, not just kicking doors. They need an operator with your diverse skill set.
Sandbox shit? Court was asking if the team's work was in the Middle East.
Primarily, some sub-Saharan Africa. I believe they were the task force that got involved in that shit in Indonesia last year. They want to train with you stateside for as short a period as they can, and then get back to Afghanistan. They've been inserting into Waziristan, Khyber, and Khurram, all the tourist hotspots. I imagine you can expect more of that.
I don't speak Pashto or Arabic,
Maurice said. Most Pakistanis speak Urdu.
Court shook his head in bewilderment. I didn't even know that. I'm not the right guy for this, Maurice.
His eyes narrowed, looking into his mentor's.
And you know I'm not. You've been sent here to pull me out and talk me into it. But you know it's bullshit, just the same as me.
I taught you how to read people. I didn't expect you'd be reading me.
Maurice smiled for an instant at this,